Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. In August 2017, hundreds of self-described white nationalists marched in the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia. They were gathered under the banner of Unite the Right and said they were there to protest the removal of a Confederate monument. The event quickly turned violent. At least 30 counter-protesters were injured and one was killed. ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson wanted to know what really happened. His reporting took him on a year-long journey chronicling the mainstreaming of hate in America. He teamed up with producers at PBS's Frontline, and the result is a pair of documentaries that chart the rise of a new, violent, white supremacist group. Thompson is both a staff reporter with ProPublica and a correspondent for Frontline. His investigations have had a number of direct impacts, including the exoneration of two innocent men sentenced to life in prison, and the federal prosecution of eight white supremacists. Sarah Childress is the senior editor at Frontline, where she's helped produce a number of award-winning documentaries. Before that, she covered Iraq for Newsweek and Sub-Saharan Africa for The Wall Street Journal, and worked as an editor for Global Post. For this discussion, I was in the moderator's seat. The panel started with an excerpt from the first documentary in this series. We're including the audio here, but if you'd like to watch the documentary, go to crosscut.com/talks and click on the episode page. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and Waldron. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
I arrived in Charlottesville for what would become the largest gathering of white supremacists in a generation. They called it Unite the Right, and it was drawing individuals from at least 35 states.
Good afternoon. I'm Chief Thomas, Charlottesville Police Department. We will have a significant police presence throughout the weekend. Well over 100 officers from my agency, several hundred officers from the Virginia State Police. We were informed that the National Guard is monitoring this situation.
The day before the rally, a few reporters gathered for the police press conference. But I'd begun to hear from other sources in Charlottesville.
We have time for one more question.
Chief, we're hearing rumors of there being another torchlight march tonight, an unpermitted march. Do you have any information about that?
I've heard the same rumors, but I don't have a lot of details. What have you heard? Where is that going to be taking place? In the city or the county?
5 or 6 o'clock.
Where at?
Not far from here is what we've been hearing.
The police had heard the same rumors I had, but the university grounds were quiet, and it seemed like the march might not be happening after all. Until suddenly, the torches appeared. Hundreds of neo-Nazis and white supremacists assembled and marched on the university. The police arrived on the scene, but watched from the sidelines as a small group of anti-racist activists were quickly surrounded. One of them, Emily Gorsensky, was streaming it from her phone.
We are penned in. We are surrounded on all sides by hundreds of Nazis. We have no way out.
I got kicked. I remember getting hit in the head. I thought it was with a torch.
I stepped forward at one point, and I got shoved back.
I thought I was going to die. The thing that I was thinking as the melee was happening was, I just need to keep the camera going, you know? That was the only thing that I could do. Yeah, it was like 100 people beating up, like, a small group of us.
And 10 or 15 people.
Yeah. You could feel how angry they were, but also how happy they were, you know, to be doing this, to be intimidating people like this, and this happy rage.
Had you ever seen that displayed before?
No, never in my life. They were cheering, they were running through the streets, yelling at people, and they walked away and they got away with it. They're coming in here the next day, ready to do more. I thought, like, here we go. Yeah, here we go.
The morning after the Torchlight March, I walked into town with a group of clergy. The white supremacists who'd beaten people the night before were returning. And anti-fascist counter-protesters were arriving to challenge them.
No hate, no fear! White supremacists are welcome here!
No hate, no fear!
White supremacists are welcome here, no hate!
No KKK, no fascists!
At 10:15, a melee erupted. White supremacists, some with their hands taped up like boxers, punched, kicked, and choked people who tried to block their path, leaving them bloodied on the pavement.
I just want to let you know, it's been all kinds of crazy violence over here. Pepper spray, people beating each other with sticks. And we're trying to figure out if the police are going to intervene to stop that or if it's just going to keep going on.
Well, we've all got different assignments to try to maintain some sort of order here, so that's what we're focusing on right now.
Hundreds of people had shown up to protest the white supremacist. Most were nonviolent, but some, black-clad, militant anti-fascists, had come to fight. And while police looked on, the crowd grew more aggressive. White supremacists formed up with shields and clubs and pushed straight into the protesters. Some of them fought back, but no one was arrested, and the violence continued to escalate. At about noon, a group of white supremacists cornered protester DeAndre Harris in a parking garage next to a police station. They beat him with poles, metal pipes, and wooden boards.
Hey, y'all cops, why is somebody dying in here? Come do your job. Come do your job. Come do your job. Come do your job.
Police did not intervene to break it up. Then at 1:45, the brawling turned into something else. An act of terror. A gray Dodge slammed into a crowd of protesters. 20 people were rushed to the hospital. 32-year-old Heather Heyer was pronounced dead.
I always wondered, was she afraid? Did she see him coming? She was deaf in one ear, so, damn it, I wasn't gonna cry. She had planned on not going. But when she saw videos from Friday night, she said, I have to go. And when you drive through Charlottesville now and see that peaceful little downtown, it's really, really hard to imagine. Even seeing the videos, it's surreal. I get cold chills every time I'm in the parking garage and have to walk past where Dre was beat up. That's just insane. Right there by the police station. The police standing right there.
For you, what does justice for Heather look like?
I don't know. I don't know that you could ever call it justice for Heather. Nothing's going to bring Heather back. Those of us who miss her forever. Her best friend said, you know, it's kind of weird. I'll get to be an old man and she'll always have been 32. You know, life goes on. I'm getting older. It's just weird. Life is very different.
Thank you. That was incredibly...
Wow, that was heavy. I hadn't seen that for a while. Yeah, same thing.
So, this is AC and Sarah, and they did that work. So. All right, so that video was shocking. Even now, to watch it, to understand that that happened. When it did happen, it was incredibly shocking to me, and I imagine to a good number of you, to see that news unfold on that day. AC, so you went into the field to Unite the Right rally in order to report a story. And then that story changed. Were you shocked by what happened?
You know, I was and I wasn't. What had happened before Unite the Right, and you saw this up here in Seattle, is there had been this whole string of right-wing demonstrations in which there had been massive violence, there had been stabbings, there had been shootings, as happened up here. There had been, you know, massive brawls. And I kind of thought, by the time things got to Charlottesville, the police would say, hey, we're not going to let that happen again. And then I got there, and I realized they were completely, completely unprepared, and that things were going to be worse than we had seen out here on the West Coast. And when I started seeing that, the first night, the torch march, the assaults, the abuse, the attacks that happened there, and the fact that basically the cops weren't anywhere around, I thought, yeah, it's entirely possible that someone is going to die this weekend.
And so, Sarah, when you were watching this, I don't know, you weren't in the field with AC, so you were watching this unfold on the news. You probably knew that AC was in the field. Did it surprise you? And what were you thinking when you were watching this unfold?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, you know, I think anybody who's been following this, like AC has, you know, you can see this drumbeat, but I don't think really, you know, that given the sort of drumbeat and the ramp up to this event, you wouldn't expect it to have turned out in the way that it did. You would expect law enforcement to be prepared to be stepping in. And I think that was the really big question that we were all left with. Like, what happened here? Like, this was an event that didn't necessarily need to happen. You know, it didn't need to play out in this way. Even if all these individuals had come, even if violence had broken out, it didn't need to end in the death of an individual. And so that was strange. And for a journalist, you know, obviously raised a lot of questions that we wanted answered.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, it really is an honor to be sitting here with both of you. I mean, you're just both such accomplished journalists. I love your work. If you have not watched the two films in this series so far, please go and watch the complete films. This was just a short sample of them. And I want to get a little bit into sort of the journalistic thinking, and we'll get into sort of the, you know, drawing on your expertise about the subject matter. But I want to know how you come out of this event, and then it's a different story, and how you decide what the story is that you're going to tell. And what was that story that you decided you're going to tell?
You know, at that time in 2017, basically there were all these sort of white supremacist leaders, and anybody who wanted to be a white supremacist leader could just say, hey, I'm Richard Spencer, and I'm the leader of the movement. I'm Matt Heimbach, and I'm a neo-Nazi, and I'm a leader of the movement. And the media were stuffing our cameras and our microphones in all these people's faces, and that's what we saw in Charlottesville. That's what we saw before and afterwards. And sort of my feeling was, and our team's feeling was, we want to look at the true architects of the violence, the people responsible for the most egregious acts, and the people who don't want to be on camera, the people who want to be in the shadows so they can terrorize their neighbors and their fellow Americans and then escape. And so that was our sort of MO at that point, was one, to sort of dissect what happened in Charlottesville, and two, to identify the people who had created the harm there and escaped.
Yeah, I would add to that. I mean, at Frontline, and certainly ProPublica, our mission is really accountability. You know, we're not advocacy journalists, and we're not interested in sort of getting into a debate about the beliefs, you know, that these individuals have. The First Amendment protections allow you to have all kinds of beliefs, and that's not really the issue. The issue is when you're crossing the line into criminality, and understanding where the accountability is. So we wanted to understand, if there are individuals who are engaging in criminality, who are engaging in violence, and we wanted to understand, what they were doing, and then also understanding and how they were operating, and then also understanding what the law enforcement response was to that. Those were the questions that we wanted to answer.
So accountability reporting is nothing new, but what you were doing was felt a little bit different, because I think that, and you talk about this leaderless resistance, right? This idea that the reason why Richard Spencer can pop up and then, become this figure is because this is a movement that doesn't have any identified leaders. Usually when we're doing accountability journalism, we focus on the leaders. But without leaders, your work then focuses on these, kind of seemingly, for lack of a better term, random people who are captured on camera committing violence. And did you have any considerations about, there was also an aspect of kind of call-out culture that was identifying people in these photos, right, on social media. Was that sort of a consideration about whether that was a line that you were stepping over? It was a different approach.
You know, the thing that really stuck out to me is I'm ancient, right? So I come from this background of, I'm looking people up in databases and looking them up in court records. And what I really realized is, social media is the native habitat of the current white supremacist movement. And if we're going to understand it, we're going to track down and identify these people, the sort of core rank and file members and the violent members of these extremist movements, we're going to have to do it through a combination of old school techniques and really mining social media, which is what a lot of people were, private citizens, citizen muckrakers were doing. I felt like, look, if you engaged in criminal activity there, if you were threatening people, if you were throwing rocks at people, if you were beating people, if you were stabbing people, you should be held to account. And I don't care what your role in the movement is. I want to understand who you are, identify you properly, get it right, and ask the authorities why they're not bothering to arrest any of the people that did these crimes.
And a result of that in your work is that the authorities actually did take some action against some of these people, right?
Yeah, so the federal government indicted 8 members of the Rise Above movement, a violent white supremacist group from California, on rioting and conspiracy charges. A bunch of those guys all said they were innocent. Most of them have pleaded guilty now, and they court-martialed U.S. Marine who was in Charlottesville and a member of a neo-Nazi group.
And so do you view what you're doing as, I mean, we saw in that video, you're talking to the police, you're telling them what's going on, they're completely unwilling and oblivious, to maybe what their role should be. I mean, is what you're doing filling in for what law enforcement won't do?
Well, I mean, we can't do that, right? We're not law enforcement. We can't arrest people. We can't, we can't step in, intervene. But what we can do is inform people, and we can ask questions. So once we had this information, once we'd positively identified, and it's not just the kind of call-out culture that, was happening on social media, like, this guy looks like this guy, and then you Google him, and then you post his address, and try to get him fired. you know, we really took a lot of time with the team of ProPublica looking through this video, looking very carefully, and making sure that we knew exactly who these individuals were. And we were also careful to take a look to make sure that the people we were focusing on were people, like AC was saying, who were actually committing acts of violence. So we were interested in sort of everyone who was there, you know, chanting or waving a banner. We were really interested in people who were breaking the law and understanding, you know, what law enforcement's response was going to be to that. And we did, you know, present that information to law enforcement and ask what their response was. And it was sort of up to them to decide, you know, what their next step would be.
And do you feel like that response has been more, I mean, has it been more appropriate than what we were seeing in that video? I mean, has law enforcement been responsive, do you think?
Yeah, I think really what happened, right, is if you go back to the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of concern about white supremacist extremists and far-right extremists in the U.S., and that all culminated in 1995 with Tim McVeigh blowing up the Oklahoma City building. There was a lot of expertise at the federal level in basically catching violent Nazis. That all went away, basically, after 9/11, and the focus shifted to another type of terrorism. And so I think what you're seeing now is the federal government and other law enforcement agencies are just starting to catch up to the true threat on the ground. And they had been basically focused on other things and didn't have that expertise for a long time. And I think now, in the last couple of years, since Charlottesville, I am seeing more appropriate, more effective law enforcement response. But at that time, I think they were very caught off guard.
Do you think that law enforcement stepping up on the federal level has made it so that we have not seen another Charlottesville since? I mean, that was kind of the, you know, I mean, it's been almost 2 years. And my thinking when Charlottesville went down was like, is this gonna start happening on a regular basis?
You know, actually, I think what's happened is that we've seen the movement shift into a different mode, right? And I think actually in some ways things are worse. Because at that time, what the white supremacist movement was doing is they were having rallies, which they would hope would turn into these street battles that would generate great YouTube clips, and they were doing that whole thing. After Charlottesville, they said, oh, we have a new plan. And the thing with white supremacists is they always see themselves as the victims. And they said, oh, we were the victims here, not Heather Heyer, who got run over by one of us and killed, not the 30 people whose bodies were strewn across the street. We're the victims. We didn't get to have our party. And so they say, we're going to do terrorism. I mean, that is what the movement has shifted to. So when you look at what happened in Pennsylvania at the Tree of Life Synagogue, when you look at what just happened in San Diego at the synagogue there, when you look at the attacks on mosques, when you look at what happened in New Zealand, that is the new wave of the white supremacist movement. So honestly, I feel like we're in a more concerning phase now, and sort of it's a post-street fighting phase.
I would say, too, it's more dangerous in the sense that because there aren't specific leaders anymore, right? This is sort of, it can be kind of written off as these lone wolf attacks, which our reporting has shown, NACI's reporting has shown, is not really what's happening, right? These are all people who are part of this movement, who are subscribing to this ideology. They're all interacting in chat rooms in ways that make it more difficult for law enforcement, right? Because before, you know, the pre-internet days, you had to get together, you had to send letters, you had to physically interact in ways that law enforcement could infiltrate, could track, could be a part of. But now anyone can go online, become radicalized, engage with these individuals, trade information, and it's hard to parse who's just sort of talking and posting and making threats and who's actually planning violence and who you actually want to move on. Because obviously, I mean, I think one of the challenges with domestic terrorism is that there isn't a federal violation in the code. Like, there's not really a law against domestic terrorism in the way that there is for international terrorism. We don't criminalize participation in groups like the Klan, like Adam Waffen, which is a group that we have covered because of the First Amendment protections, right? You don't really want to criminalize thought or speech. And so, you know, with international groups, we can designate, if you're a member of Al-Qaeda, if you're a member of ISIS, if you're providing, you know, they have a law against providing material support for terrorist groups. So if you're giving them money or showing up, you can be targeted, you can be prosecuted. But we don't have that for domestic terrorism. And so the only way you can pursue someone who's engaging in this is not if they're talking about it, not even if they're talking about killing whole groups of people. That's still protected speech. The only time when it becomes a crime is when you say, hey, on Tuesday, let's go and attack this. this particular these particular individuals. So so monitoring that makes it, you know, the way that the movement has shifted, it makes it a lot more difficult to monitor and to prosecute and to report on, you know, frankly.
So the way that the movement has grown through sort of social and video platforms is certainly disconcerting, and I think that, you know, one of the things that you do in the first video that is intentional is that you're really on the outside of this group, and you're kind of, you know, pointing them out, and you're not talking to them, you know. You're not really giving them sort of, you're not handing them a microphone, essentially. Mm-hmm. The second video is a little different, because actually the second video focuses on this Adam Waffen group, which was a part of the Unite the Right rally, but really becomes the focus. And you actually go and interview the spiritual godfather of the group, James Mason, who's the author of a book called Siege, which is kind of the Bible of this group. And you go to his house and you sit down with him, and it is a shocking interview. I mean, he calls Timothy McVeigh a hero. He says that Heather Heyer's death was excusable. I mean, it's just really, you know, some difficult stuff to watch. Do you worry about giving someone like that a platform? And what was the discussion about whether or not you were going to allow that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you should absolutely chime in on this too. We had a lot of controversy within our television and reporting team about whether we wanted to put that guy on camera. We interviewed former members of the group who said, like, these are the objectives, this is what they want to do, it's a terrorist group. But there were people who had left the movement, and we sort of thought, like, they give a real good window into it. Our bosses said, like, hey, we're living in this incredibly anti-Semitic moment. We're living in this moment where there are these terror attacks, where we have this new wave of neo-Nazis, and we really need to understand and what is motivating them and what their deal is. And I personally, I didn't want to put that interview in the film, and I argued against it. And then I thought, you know, maybe we should say that we're not going to put it, you know, we did the interview, but we're not going to show it. And then other people said, no, that doesn't make sense. And eventually our boss said, look, it's important for people to understand their enemy and understand the forces that would annihilate them, that would wipe them off the face of the earth, that despise them. And we will give a brief hearing to that person to understand the depth of their extremity, the depth of their misanthropy, and we will condemn it as we do that in the film. And so that was the sort of debate. But you should chime in. And people have told us, like, you shouldn't have done that, you shouldn't have given a platform, and I totally understand that perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. It was definitely an intense debate. I think, you know, the first cut actually had a lot more of him in it. Yeah. It was a lot, and it was also towards the end, so we were giving this guy kind of the last word, and we felt like that was not okay. You know, I think that, you know, AC sort of captured what the thinking was, that you want to understand. You know, as journalists, we really want to understand, but you also don't want to give it a microphone, give it a platform in a way that really lets them sort of air out their ideas, right? I mean, you could kind of get the gist, right? You know, they're pretty straightforward. I think this was happening also in the context of, you know, other media outlets were doing these really fawning profiles of folks like Richard Spencer and talking about his, you know, cool outfit and how he was good looking. And so, you know, we really didn't want to make these people seem, you know, glorify them or, you know, elevate
them. Make them seem
hip. Make them seem, yeah, right, hip, like the new, edgy new white supremacy. It was just not something we were interested in engaging in. So we put him in the end. I think, you know, the idea was we do need to understand. I mean, that was the primary thing. You know, why would we talk to someone? We talk to people because we want to understand what they are thinking. Because, you know, the focus of the film was moving into this understanding this leaderless resistance, which is something that he was calling for, this evolution of their operations. We needed to understand where that idea came from and how that how that worked. And so that's, we put him in the film with a mind to doing that. And so we allowed him to say those things and allow him to air enough of his views so you understood why they were so repugnant, and then we moved on.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I guess the last thing I would say real quickly about that is, I guess what we wanted people to understand is, like, when these people say that they want to kill, they do. They really mean it. When they say that they want to engage in terrorism, that's really what they want to do. It's not a joke. And that's a group that's killed 5 people and plotted to blow up a bunch of stuff. So that was the other thing.
So just, you both have a depth of knowledge about this area. And, you know, Sarah, you've written about militias quite a bit, or worked on work on militias. AC, you've been covering white supremacy and white nationalism for a couple decades. Give us a sense of where we are right now in sort of, like, is there a historical precedent for where we're at? When you think about where it's at, what do you, what's the analogy that you come up with?
You know, I mean, I think it's important to look at the long sort of timeline. And I think, like I was talking about earlier, when you look at the white supremacist movement, the far right movement, 80s and 90s, it kind of culminated with the Oklahoma City bombing. A lot of people left the movement after that, and they said, you know what, I thought I wanted to go to war against the government, but actually I saw those dead children, and now I don't. And at that time, you also had a really intense government response to white terrorism. That was sort of the apex of that iteration of the movement. But I think it's important to understand, when you come up to 2008, and the U.S. has its first African-American president, he's a president who's an unabashed former community organizer, liberal, who says, you know, I think maybe guns and unregulated guns are a problem. That really started the white power movement back on the ascendancy. And that's really where you see the current ascendancy. You come to 2015, 2016, and you have a presidential candidate who is saying racist things, who's saying nativist things, saying anti-immigration things, and saying it in a very blunt way. That really helped catalyze a new generation and a new wave of white supremacist groups. So then you saw an explosion of new groups, of new activism, of new activity. And you had white supremacist groups for the first time in decades saying, we support this presidential candidate. Whereas before, they would always say about Republican and Democratic presidential candidates, well, neither of them are radical enough for us. But Donald Trump was radical enough for the current movement and to inspire the current movement. So he has played, I would say, a sort of key catalytic role in the current movement. Not controversial, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, Sarah. What do you, I mean, do you see in, I mean, you know, it's, these are neo-Nazis. Mm-hmm. You know, what, you know, is there something to learn from the history of Nazism in the, you know, in the 20th century? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out where we go from here. Like, what is the path forward?
I think the path forward is difficult to say. I think one thing that that you can see when you look at the trends is that these groups are energized when they have something to oppose. So you saw them rise under, you know, Obama. That was, you know, as you see, that was, you know, you saw white supremacist groups and militia groups, which used to be really sort of, you know, in the same, you know, all sort of in the same pool, and now for the most part are kind of separate groups, but still formed in opposition to the government, to a liberal president, you know, for the white supremacists, to a black president. And so with the election of Trump, who many of them saw as, you know, siding with them, you know, regardless of, you know, his own perspective. I mean, he said that he disavowed white nationalism, the Klan, when they endorsed him. He said he disavowed that. So, but nevertheless, they see him as someone who espouses their ideals and beliefs. And so, from the militia movement perspective, those folks kind of have declined a lot because there's not much to fight, right? It was all about fighting the government and, you know, the government taking your guns. Well, you know, this president is not taking their guns, and so there's not much to fight. But the white supremacist movement, I think, is a little bit different this time, and I'm not sure you know, what the next step is. I mean, we're seeing these attacks, we're seeing these sort of, you know, one-off attacks, individuals sort of deciding that they're going to go out and do something. I think the, you know, I think you see this in Europe as well with the rise of nationalism. It's happening in opposition to the refugee crisis. And in the United States, we have obviously this immigration crisis. It's something that is used to fuel a lot of nativism, a lot of racism and xenophobia. And I think, so that presents a kind of, you know, something to mobilize around and to talk about. I think that there's, and there's a, you know, there's a spectrum of that conversation, right? There's the folks that are just, you know, overtly racist, and then there's folks who are sort of a little further forward on the spectrum. But it sort of allows people to sort of organize around that. So
there's one more topic that I want to touch on, and then I'm going to be asking a few of your questions. So make sure to send those to Slido. Really, the last thing I want to talk about is, you know, is forward looking. AC, you wrote for ProPublica following the New Zealand mosque murders that about this manifesto that the shooter put out, and how it has, you know, that it has sort of infiltrated the popular social and video platforms that we all use, and that these companies are having trouble getting their arms around it, or maybe aren't trying enough. I guess my question is, if the tech companies were able to, like, employ enough moderators, get the right tech, get their arms around this, really shut down these voices from these major platforms, would that be enough? Or has it become so widespread, and are there enough kind of avenues of communication that are underground that that isn't enough?
You know, that's a really good question. I think it's kind of two things, right? And I think the first thing is that when you look at the efforts of the big social media giants to sort of clamp down on violent, threatening, racist, noxious speech, they've done a really bad job at it. You know, they allegedly banned a few more people on Facebook this week. But when I go to YouTube, because I research this stuff, and I put in Vanguard Streaming Network, I get the YouTube channel for this Nazi outfit with a big SS in their logo. And YouTube then starts suggesting to me like 50 other white supremacist channels. And they think I'm a Nazi. I'm like, I'm not a Nazi. I'm here for the cat videos and to research these guys. So the first thing is they're doing a bad job at that. They can do a much better job. They have the technology to do it now. It's not that hard. But the second thing is, you're absolutely right. Like, even if you push those people off of the major platforms, that is a big step. It's an important step, and it would absolutely cut back on the organizing ability and the ability to disseminate information in that scene. But it would still persist. It would still persist in underground channels. It would still persist in private chats. It would still persist in private groups. And it's not going to go away, but that would limit it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look at Europe, which has really strict laws on hate speech. They don't allow these groups to speak in the way that we do here. And you're still seeing a rise in white nationalism there. You're still seeing attacks and groups organizing. So it's not something that you can stamp out just by blocking them.
Right, there's so many more questions I want to ask you, but I'm going to sacrifice for you people to ask some of your questions. So hold on just a second.
Technology failed.
It was going so smoothly. Okay, while I'm getting this fixed, Austin, can you help me out? So there's a third documenting hate film in the works. Speaking of Europe, AC is not involved because you are working on something else that's probably.
But I'll swing back to the Nazis at some point.
Okay, great. Sarah, can you tell us whatever you can tell us about what this third installment is?
Yeah, I mean, just briefly, it's sort of, the idea is to pick up a thread that we uncovered in Charlottesville there's an individual, Robert Rundo, who was identified in these videos as a member of this Rise Above movement, which is basically a white supremacist fight club. They get together, they train, and then they go to rallies and beat people up. And when AC circled back to find him after Charlottesville, when AC circled back to find him after Charlottesville, he was already in Europe. Connecting with other people. And that's something that we hadn't seen before as these movements were sort of evolving on their own in their own countries. But now you're seeing these individuals interacting directly and finding common ground, in part because of, as I mentioned before, the immigration and the refugee crisis and the migrants in Europe. But you're seeing in Europe for several years this sort of bubbling up of nativism, of questions about what a European is, European culture, and preserving kind of a white identity for Europe in the face of rising numbers of immigrants coming in. So the fact that these groups are finding common ground with each other is certainly, and inspiring each other is certainly a troubling trend and something we want to take a look at.
Well, I mean, I look forward to that. I don't know. That's tough to say. All right, so we got this working. Thank you, Austin. So Mary asks, how do you think this narrative or the reaction changes if Heather Heyer isn't a young white woman?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, obviously, who can predict. But, I do think that we see in the way that media covers, individuals, people of color, there can be less of a priority or less of value placed on those individuals. So, I think it could have changed the picture. I think that the fact that she, but I think also the fact that she went there, as her mother said, because she saw this reaction on Friday night, this lack of police engagement, as you have tons of marchers coming and beating people. And she was planning to stay home, but decided to go anyway because she felt she had to stand up. I thought that that was significant and important. And I don't want to, I wouldn't want to diminish her death or the outpouring of support that came after that by sort of considering that dynamic much further. I mean, I think, the fact that people saw someone die and were horrified by what happened, I think is significant.
Okay. AC, you have anything to add to that? So while 9/11 shifted priorities from the top down, have you run into sympathy in law enforcement to far-right ideology that drives a blind eye from the group up?
Yeah, I think you definitely see some of that. And I would say, there was the crying Nazi, Chris Cantwell, was when he was in jail in Virginia, he called the police department there and said, oh yeah, all these leftists, these Antifa should be put in a wood chipper, right? And the person on the other end of the line at the police department laughed and thought that was real funny. Like, I wouldn't find that funny. So I think there is, at times, some sympathy between far-right groups from law enforcement. But I would say actually the biggest nexus that we've seen as journalists in the last couple of years is with the military. And most military folks have no interest in white supremacist groups, have nothing to do with them, but there is a small kind of key core of white supremacists who are active in the military. And that's, I think, what we've seen more of.
Yeah, and that is a big part of the sort of identity that you sketch out, but I mean, more than that, who are these people? Because you do sort of avoid kind of painting with a broad brushstroke, but for all of us, what's the profile of the modern white supremacist?
Overwhelmingly young men under 30 from sort of mainstream middle class families, bright, alienated, but bright. Often college educated, highly internet focused, highly social media focused, but I would say really different than sort of their predecessors in that movement, who often came from sort of paramilitary backgrounds or had been survivalists or militia types and were living in backwoods compounds in the Pacific Northwest. I would say a very different sort of profile.
Another question here. How large is the neo-Nazi movement in terms of numbers, if you were to estimate?
Yeah, I mean, that's a thing that nobody really has a good handle on it. I mean, I would say very small, like relatively to the size of America, with more than 300 million people, very small movement, but a movement because of its desire to engage in terrorism and exterminate its perceived foes, very potent.
So Frank here has an interesting question, which I think that journalists who cover these things struggle with a lot, which is, you know, by drawing so much attention to neo-Nazis and white supremacists, white nationalists, are you really taking the focus off of kind of the institutionalized racism that pervades our culture and society and politics?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. You know, I think both are important. You know, I mean, I think that's and you know, we explore systemic racism through other films and other reporting. So it's certainly not something. It's not an either or kind of question. But I do think it's important to take a look at these groups because they are engaged in violence and they're working to do harm, and they have done harm. And I think without sort of understanding them, understanding where they're coming from, where they're getting their ideas, and how they're operating, you know, we leave a blind spot that is, that's problematic. So I think it's important to take a look at these groups. But yeah, that obviously doesn't mean that, they're the only elements of racism in our society and then they're only the only problematic kind of racism, because obviously systemic racism and those who work to uphold that are also worthy of scrutiny and accountability reporting that we continue to do.
Another member of the audience asks if you believe that this is a crisis. And I would just add to that, if there's a new president in 2021, what can that president do to start tamping down this issue? What action can be taken?
I mean, the current president could actually set the tone from the top and not engage in persistent, constant, divisive, nativist and racist rhetoric, right? So, like, you could start there.
He could do that, yeah.
You know, and I would say, like, that would be a good place to start for the next president, is not to be a demagogue. That's, like, the good starting point.
Right. Good answer.
I can add something to that as well.
This is the professional voice here.
Obviously, leadership can set the tone, but I also think it's a matter of resources for law enforcement and making it a priority among law enforcement from federal agencies on down. So, you know, if they don't have the resources, the manpower to be investigating, to be sharing this information with local, state and local law enforcement, then they're not able to do the kind of work, the day-to-day work that needs to be done to ferret these folks out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we are at time. I just have one more question, short answer, lightning round. What do you do for self-care? Because this is very difficult work. How do you get your mind off of this?
Wine and chocolate.
How are you, AC?
You know, I just try to shut this down when I go home, and like at the end of the day, I try to just actually be focused on my family, on my friends, and not think about these people.
It helps to remember that this is, again, a small section of society. It's easy when you're immersed in it to think, God, everybody is horrible. And which, you know,
yes.
Many people are, right? But, you know, present company excluded. But I think remembering that, being with family, like AC said, being with family and friends and realizing that there's actually most of the people in the world are good and trying to do good.
It's
helpful.
That's a wonderful note to end on, right? So Sarah Childress, AC Thompson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you all so much. Those are great questions. Enjoy the festival.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Victoria Ralph and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And to sign up for announcements about the next Crosscut Festival, go to crosscut.com/festival. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.